This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. You are It's Getting Real Oppie Outside of Music, News, and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. What's that in the background? It's Taylor Swift. It's opening night. The Eras Tour, playing Tim McGraw, her debut single from a lot of years ago. I was fortunate enough to be at the opening night of the Eras Tour and wrote about it. Tim McGraw is a personal favorite of mine. I was very excited when she played that as her sort of special song on all the dates she's been doing, back catalog, new songs at each gig. I was very, very happy that I got to see Taylor Swift do Tim McGraw, a very, very special recording and performance. The Eras Tour is, I mean, it's over. It's not over, but it's like the main part domestically, it's over. There's going to be some shows in Mexico, and then there's a European leg. And then if I had to guess, they will probably circle back and do some more shows here. And everybody's gone to Eras Tour, a lot of people. And we have not really talked about the tour extensively on Popcast. And so I felt like here's an opportunity to speed round a little bit, bring in some folks who saw different dates, talk about their experiences, talk about different segments or perspectives or angles on the show. So on this week's podcast, we've got three conversations. First, Wesley Morse is going to check in. Wesley saw the show in New Jersey. We're going to talk about Taylor and Beyonce and Taylor at this particular cultural moment in her career and how we perceive her and kind of how this tour serves as a document of that. After Wesley, Brian Siebert is calling in. Brian's a dance critic for The Times, and Brian wrote about Taylor's dancing or non-dancing and the way that she uses her body to communicate, sometimes not through movement specifically. So Brian will check in on that. And then finally, Yossi Salik from Bandsplain is going to check in with us. Yossi saw the show in LA, as did Brian, and going to talk about, I believe it was her first Taylor experience. And I mean, we already had the conversation. It's a rowdy conversation. So just buckle up for that one. But let's start it off right. It's Wesley Morris, New York Times critic at large, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Went to the Eras Tour. Wesley, what are you dealing with?
Well, listen, I should say, first of all, thanks for having me, John.
Hi.
Second, 146 dates to be done.
Mm.
I had a conversation with myself about how many Beyoncés I was going to see.
Yeah, okay.
And like a lot of people, I mean, I'm not seeing very many of those. But the idea that there's a person out there who might be going to most of the 146 shows Taylor Swift is going to play is really something.
Well, I know a person. I know a person.
Who's that?
Taylor Swift. Oh. I'm tired of all this fan energy. Like, I went to 20 shows. I went to 4. Hey, you know who else went? Taylor Swift. You know what she did? She performed for 3 hours at each of those shows. That's nice.
3 hours? You need to jack that up.
Fine. Whatever the athletes who are filming the videos from the VIP boxes are saying, wow, the stamina, I'm really impressed. Like, whatever they're saying, it's that. Fine. But Taylor showed up 146 times. You went back in Jersey, right? Not New York slash Jersey. You went in Jersey. Okay.
We'll never do it again, by the way. That was my last MetLife Stadium show.
Yeah.
I'll never do it again.
A brutal exercise. Like, that's how you know you're a dedicated fan, if you voluntarily do that. I went to the opener, which is fine, but I did not go in Jersey because I did not wish to brave the thing that I imagine you had to brave, which is just the logistical nightmare of doing that.
It just sucks. And it sucks to see football there. It sucks to see major recording artists there. I would just as soon fly to any other place in the U.S. than go see a show. With all due respect to MetLife Stadium, it's just not in a fun place to go.
Doesn't need your respect. It's okay. It's just a stadium.
I know. But some people I love work there and, you know.
Great. Well,
I just.
Bless them.
I don't want to. It's all right. I hate going. I'll never go again. No more shows for me.
Okay. First time seeing Taylor or no?
It is my third Taylor Swift live concert experience.
Where on the arc, where does this sit? And also, what do you think she was doing this go around that felt novel or unexpected based on your prior experience?
There's no comparison. This is far and away the best live Taylor Swift experience I've ever had. There's something kind of, I mean, this show is coming along at a really interesting moment for everything, right? For Taylor Swift, for like large scale live performance, for, I mean, whatever we're thinking about, whatever we mean when we're talking about feminism, the sort of dismantling or challenging or sort of satirization of patriarchy. I don't know. I just was really moved by and terrified, I should also say, by the display of power, the embodiment of power, but also the arsenal that these fans represent night after night. Right. There are lots of people in the crowd like me who are just going to
have a great time.
Or, well, not even like, OK, everybody's there to have a great time. I'm not there to support anybody or anything. I just want to see a show. Right. But Taylor Swift, we're calling these people fans. Right. They're constituents.
Even that's generous, to be honest. As someone who's been on the wrong side of them, it's a little bit more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's come back to the extra musical aspects of what it's like to experience this live.
Talk about the power.
She can sing so much better than she could when I saw her.
She's so much better now.
Yeah. And I don't know how, you know, it's funny because I am recently back from St. Louis and seeing Beyonce.
Yes.
Like this happened days ago. And you know, the way that show is structured, Beyonce comes out, as you know, and she sings like 6 ballads.
Yes. And I should qualify this. I have yet to see the Renaissance tour. I'm hoping to go soon. I just have not been able to like make the schedule work. I've followed it closely. Like I'm aware of the structure. Yeah.
It's better than you just.
Yeah, I know.
Ready yourself.
I'm sure it is. Yeah.
But okay, she comes out, she does these 6 songs to open the show. Ballads, her voice, her singing is so good, so unassistedly good. So, I mean, she's the best Fraser in, I mean, Tony Bennett just died. Of the people who can go out, like Cecile McLaurin-Savant, people I'm scared of when they start to sing a song, terrify me. Beyonce is up there. She can do anything to a song now. And that is an exciting, exciting proposition. But the what it takes of to go out there night after night and sound that precise, while also for Beyonce sounding newly free, happy, like something has been lifted off her. This is something that I think comes, and we've talked a lot about, you and I on this show have talked before about what it means to be a 40-year-old pop star. But to be a 33-year-old pop star, 33, first of all, for a Christian, let's just talk about 33, right? And what it means to be in your 33rd year and to feel like there's something that you have to get off your chest and there's something weighing on you. To go out and sort of celebrate your career at 33 is a, and to stipulate that the show is about those, what, the 17 years you've been famous or whatever? I don't know what the number is, but, and you know, the songs you've written and the experiences you've had, to not shed the weight the way Beyonce has, but to like, to lift it. You know, I feel like the Formation tour was about Beyonce shouldering something. And Taylor Swift is now, this is kind of her Formation tour. I know I'm feel like I'm committing a sort of blasphemy here for these Taylor Swift people, but like,
I think you might be committing blasphemy for the Beyonce people, respectfully.
Well, whoever. I'm yeah. sure that like, but the point is just like, John, there are two people left. Tina Turner is dead.
Yeah, if, frankly, because it...
Right. I mean, in terms of like, this is an interesting, that's a great if. Because, you know, the show itself, Taylor sounds great. What you appreciate for several plus hours, because it ain't three hours.
Okay, fair. Fair.
Am I wrong?
No, no, I think you're right.
It did not feel like 3 hours. And I don't mean that as a slight. I mean, it was longer than 3 hours. What you appreciate is, even live, she is one of our great songwriters.
Oh, of course.
And the tradition that she comes from is very obvious, right? The James Taylor, Carly Simon, you know, her influence is Paul Simon. You know, her influences are, or her peers in that regard, maybe Elton John, you know, Lionel Richie, like those people. The thing that she's doing, she's committed to a spectacle that those people, with all, I mean, Elton John, I guess, is a different thing. But the presentation, I never think of her as like a visual, somebody I want to watch.
Okay. This to me ties into an ongoing question that I've had with Taylor since, I mean, really since Red, but like for sure since Reputation, which is...
my favorite Taylor album.
I mean, it's an essential record that is remains underloved despite me talking about it every 2 to 3 weeks on this show. I really should just do a full spinoff Reputation song by song show. If we were at the Ringer, we would have our own show, limited run, just dissecting the songs.
Don't say that too loud, because Bill will try to hire us.
Yeah,
to do
just Reputation, not every album ever, every song on Reputation. That's the whole show.
She didn't do enough Reputation in that part of the show.
You are correct. But here, okay, so this is something that I feel like most of my Taylor thinking in the last, let's call it 7 or 8 years, has been about, which is the nature of pop success and the stardom that goes with it that Taylor is naturally best at is not something that is scaled the way that the Eras Tour is scaled. And I think this is the fundamental tension that Reputation really got at, which is just like Taylor was like, actually, I can make a pop album that's like kind of just as pneumatic drill intensity as any of these other pop queens. I can do that.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think the reason that record is not loved is because people are sort of like, that's kind of not what we want from you. That's that's not the Taylor that like the average 13-year-old. Mostly girls are signing up for.
It's Dark Taylor.
But
I mean, it's Dark Taylor and it's Dark Taylor.
Yes. It sure is. And it is not a coincidence that what follows not that long after that is the Folklore Evermore duo. You know, COVID aside, something like that was coming, regardless of COVID, something like that.
She pulled a Beck.
Boy, did she. And, you know, sort of retreating to the light in all the ways.
Yeah.
So for me, watching these Taylor tours over the years, there's always been kind of like a slight awkward tension. There's a frisson between the thing that Taylor is, I think, purely great at and the demands of being famous at that level. And it's not, she couldn't pull an Ed Sheeran where it's just like, it's just me and my guitar.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd be curious to see what that would look like, but like,
well, it's in the show, right?
In bits and pieces, but you know, to do it for a whole 3+ hours, I just don't think she's going to do that. I think she believes fundamentally the spectacle is what's expected of her. This is the first of the tours where I thought she landed on a visual idea and narrative that both protected the thing that she's good at, but was also scaled in a way to accommodate 60,000 people a night for 150 nights. I've seen big Taylor shows before that I thought were great, but I was always like, I don't know if Taylor herself is the most comfortable. Everybody's having a great time, but I'm not totally sure if this is the most comfortable setting for her. This show, even though I had some quibbles with it, as narrative, felt like a 33-year-old adult who has been famous more than half her life, who has been through a bunch of musical waves, you want to call them eras, whatever you want to do, but who has been around long enough to understand how to take a stage of that scale on terms that are more friendly to her, rather than inhabiting terms that predated her and figuring out if she fits into those terms. That's how this show felt to me in macro.
I have a question for you. Well, now I want to talk about the music.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have all these sort of like extra musical things to think about, but like my favorite part of the show came early. The thing I love about it is that it wasn't chronological. So you didn't know which albums were going to come when. And I really loved that she started with Lover. It's one of my favorite Taylor Swift albums as a complete album. It's got two horrendous songs, but other than that, I really like it as an album. You're given the half and half hand sign, like you.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's. But see, I think Midnights is fine.
Lover is good to very good. Midnights is, it's okay.
But the thing that I love about the structure of the show is it's not chronological. So the albums come whenever they come. I mean, she's built the show, I think, for energy. And I think that the high points of the show have everything to do with the wedding of songcraft to stagecraft. I mean, some of it is like kitschy, like the idea that they build this Midtown office to do the man, basically, and she runs around in the blazer, and it's like a little school play. I love that. I love that there's a kind of drama kid in her, like a theater kid in her. And this show lets a lot of that out. And, you know, she's got these dancers. And the unfortunate thing for me is that I saw this show in the middle of this stupid Matty Healy, Ice Spice, you know, who can remember it now? But at the time it was like, oh God, we're going. It was the news. Like, is she going to bring Ice Spice out? Is Ice Spice even going to come? There was a kind of charge that I at least brought to this show where I was a little bit annoyed by the fact that her dancers were mostly Black people and, you know, non-white people. And that Taylor Swift does not need dancers.
Well, yeah, but this, yeah.
But as it turns out, she does. Or they do something for
her. What do they do?
Right? Okay, well, it's not that the dancers are dancers. They're friends.
Okay, but let me ask this. What do they do for her versus what do they do for the viewer? Mm-hmm. Are those the same thing?
They could be. I think what I love about the dancers as dancers is they're really good dancers.
And she's not.
And she's not. But there's nothing aspirational from the standpoint of dancerliness about having them there. The aspiration to me is that these are people that she'd have in her life.
Yes.
I'm going to say this with reputation in mind, where I, and this connects in some ways to this arsenal, this constituency, this proletariat. I think that she is carrying a burden of whiteness.
Like knowingly.
No, I think it's being displaced upon her. The way the music's entered the culture, the way it functions, the way that, you know, depending on which producer she's working with, it has some tangential relationship to where, you know, pop music writ large generally tends to be. Although, is she not pop music writ large at this point? Mm. Who can say? But if you look at, you know, she's got 10 albums in the top 200 album chart.
Perversely, I feel like outside of moments like Reputation, like she is kind of her own microclimate. It's just a huge microclimate. But
I don't know if Olivia Rodrigo would, I mean, I don't know if she would beg to differ, but I think Taylor would be begging to differ about Olivia.
Right. Rodrigo. But I do think like there is something a little bit one of one-ish about the Olivia Taylor. I mean, it's a whole separate episode, Olivia Taylor.
Yeah, sure. Of course. Anyway, you know, the pleasure for me of going to this show was being reminded that she is so much more complicated an artist than I'd previously been allowed to think she was. You know, seeing all of these songs happen in a matter of hours and seeing the temperature of the show itself change in, I would say, shrewd ways. Like the Evermore folklore sections, they kind of drooped a little bit, honestly. I don't know what drew her to which songs or why she picked the one she picked. I mean, she picked, you know, a couple winners from both those albums, but not the ones that I thought would have played better under the circumstances of this production.
As much as this is the Eras tour, it's also her first opportunity to tour any of this material or to even workshop.
That's
to fair. Even workshop any of this material. And so I think on some level, you just don't know until you hit the stage. And by the time you've assembled your bulletproof 3.5 hour set to go out and replicate 150 times, you know, if you happen to have a lag in there, you're just not going to know. You're not going to know until you've tried it out five times.
Are you going to see it again?
Yeah, I would like to. It's seeing it through the eyes of writing, having to write a review very quickly and so on and so forth. It's just a different sort of experience than allowing yourself to not take notes and really see it kind of almost more expansively instead of seeing it on this kind of like micro detail level. So yeah, I'd like to, but you know, life's funny. Who knows?
Cause I actually would. I mean, I'd be willing to go to Europe and see what she would change. I would consider it.
Let's sync G-cals.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. Can I ask some other questions?
Yes.
Because there are some things that have happened during this show. I mean, every iteration of it, we're going to have it for like 18 months or something, right? And news comes out of these shows. You know, she paid, I don't know if the entire crew got $100,000 bonuses, but
seems
looks
like
everybody got a bonus. That's meaningful. She weathered the Matt Healy Ice Spice scandalette. The night I saw her, she was handling
the John Mayer thing.
The John Mayer thing. Unlike Beyonce, Taylor Swift doesn't have control. She does not have complete control
of her narrative.
Well, you know, because of the way that she is public and the way that she is sort of chronically monogamous, you know, I think that these other people have narratives too. And I think that the way that she's able to weather all those things and be a kind of conscientious steward of her own odyssey in some ways is really interesting to me. Like, I don't know what inspired her to give that money away, but I don't know why we know that the money was given. There are all of these other competing elements that she has to weather. Because at the end of the day, one of the cozy things about this tour, to me, is that she only does it, what, twice a week?
Yeah, it's right. They're weekend shows.
Two or three times a week, the weekends. So she gets to like gallivant around whatever city she's in. It's a pretty good situation, or come back to New York.
Yeah, I mean, I think she hits the PJ after the show, the last show is done, and goes somewhere.
I like the approach to this. I don't know how it's sustainable if you're like a mother of two or three, right, with a husband and stuff. But this is definitely like, talk about single ladies.
Yes.
It's really been hitting me the last couple of months that there is a post-pandemic. There is a psychic toll, and some of it is going to look terrible. Like, there are things about us that aren't going to be the same since the pandemic, right? But then there are going to be things like this tour. This tour does not happen without people being cooped up in the house and still feeling, I mean, I don't have this, but I'm also not a 15-year-old who missed out on these crucial years of my life. And I just wonder whether or not there's some aspect of this tour that is just like, I am never going to be cooped up again. I don't even know what cooped up is for a person like Taylor Swift, but like, there's something here that is like extra liberatory. That's different from the way Beyonce seems free.
That's fascinating, because I have had moments of thinking, maybe it's a complementary thought to what you're saying, which is this might be it, which is not to say never tour again, of course, but that this may be the, I am doing it at such a high level, at such a degree of engagement, at such a moment of aggregated interest. Personal, professional, musical, etc. You know, this is it's my MVP season, unanimous vote MVP season, and then I never have to do this again at this level in this way.
But what does it look like? What does the alternative look like?
Maybe an incredible series of residencies. So it's not.
What I love about this.
I don't look.
You didn't go to Vegas.
I don't disagree. But I'm saying maybe it's a series of residencies. Maybe it's a handful of spot. Maybe it's not 150. Maybe it's 30. You know, if Harry Styles can play the Garden 8 nights in a row, Taylor Swift can certainly play MetLife Stadium 8 nights in a row if she so chooses.
God help her.
And you, I think your point about being not a parent, you can do this. And if her personal life develops and changes, this may not be a choice that she would want to make. And not to say that you can't do all the things, but it's a lot. It's a lot of labor.
I mean, Beyonce, Blue Ivy is part of the tour.
That's from like literally part of the tour, literally part of the tour.
I think we might be thinking about eras the wrong way.
Okay.
This is a smart person. She knows what eras are. I don't think the eras are hers. I think the eras are ours. All the periods that we have lived through as she's been making music. Because we're not the same as we were, even in relation to her, now as we were 15 years ago. And I think this is a kind of like, I mean, to the extent that I'm willing to call this a kind of liberal political act, there is something kind of hopeful and optimistic in bringing all of these changed people together in one space.
Okay.
The night I went, it was mostly white women. I think after white women, the number two demographic group identifiable with your eyes was Asian women of all kinds. There were a handful of black people. That's one way to think about the response to her. But like among the people who went, they weren't all the same. And I think 15 years ago, we were just different people. And 15 years ago, Taylor Swift was somebody who got criticized for sounding terrible at the Grammys.
Yep.
You know,
we were there.
Couldn't sing. This gawky teenage kid Why is she out here? What is she the future of? We have changed. And I mean, I guess she's probably changed too. I don't know her, but she has certainly become a much more complicated musician while maintaining some real fundamental gift for the turn of like emotional phrase, intimacy phrasing, you know, while also becoming a better singer. She and Lionel Richie are the hardest karaoke people who aren't rappers to me.
Wow.
They're just the most difficult people to do in karaoke.
Interesting.
The most difficult singer-songwriters. But I think this tour is as much about the people who claim to love her as it is about the different ways she's looked over the years. Because she's not Madonna. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just struck me as patently strange.
If there are Taylor Swift eras, there's like three. You know, like right. if there's like three. So that's an interesting way to kind of, I think, wrap it up and tie it together, which is to say you can sell the concept of an eras tour as being this kind of personal statement or manifesto or whatever.
Shirts say that.
Yes.
Basically.
But right. But it only works if the people who buy the tickets believe it, or like it echoes with them in some way. It only really works. And so maybe you're right. Maybe we are the eras. That's wild.
You know, there are people going to this show who were way different people at the beginning of their fandom.
Yes.
Than they are now. I don't know which direction they went, you know, but they're probably different. They're adults in a lot of cases. They're parents in a lot of cases taking their kids.
Yes. Adults. Debatable. Wesley, what a blessing.
Thanks for having me.
What Taylor song should we go out with?
The one she didn't do at the show that I was so bummed she didn't do. I Did Something Bad, which has that great chorus. I mean,
craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
I would be complex. I would be cool. They'd say I played the field before I found someone to commit to. And that would be okay for me to do. Every conquest I had made would make me more of a boss to you.
That was The Man, a very important late period Taylor Swift song. And we're playing The Man because there is a gestural thing that Taylor does on tour at the Eras Tour that I noticed when I saw the show and was drawn attention to by Brian Siebert, who writes dance criticism for The New York Times. Brian's here. Welcome, Brian.
Hello.
Happy to have you to talk about a very particular and perhaps underappreciated part of the tour, which is Taylor's dancing, or maybe lack thereof, strategic lack of dancing. We'll talk about that. Last week, or a couple weeks ago, actually, you wrote a piece, How to Command a Stage Without Great Dance Moves, Taylor's Version. Wah, wah. And you went to the show in L.A., and I wonder if you can talk about, before we get into the specifics of Eras Tour.
Yeah.
Have you been to big pop spectacles like this before, keeping an eye on this kind of this part of the presentation? Or was this something, was this like a new approach, a novel approach?
It is a rare approach. There aren't so many shows that get to the level of warranting dance criticism. Exactly. Convincing an editor that that angle is needed. Right. Yeah. I did it before with Beyonce's Formation tour.
Sure. Which
needed that.
And also deployed dance, I would say, in a more complicated way than maybe Taylor did.
Definitely a different way. We can start there. Okay. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your takeaways from seeing how Taylor deploys movement. Because obviously, when we think of dance, you know, obviously we are thinking of dancing, but also we're thinking of body movement in space.
Body movement and theatricality. How do you... Bodies in space and a huge space, right?
Very huge.
Small body, a normal-sized human body against a stadium and one person with 70,000 people. Those dynamics, so what I was thinking about from a dance critic perspective. Certainly the first thing that struck me was just her incredible connection with the audience. I mean, you feel somehow that she has a personal connection to every single person. It's one in 70,000, and each person is having this connection with her. I mean, and that's especially true in her concerts because, you know, you're there and it seems like everyone knows all the words to every song. But it seemed to me that the dance actually was part of how that connection was maintained. And in a couple ways, one way was, and this is where I was afraid I was going to get attacked by the Swifties.
Theme on this episode, I'm just sure, FYI.
That she's not a great dancer. She is a singer who dances, and she chooses, because she has these different eras and different styles, to go into a pop style sometimes. And what comes with that is a certain kind of dancing with backup dancers.
Yeah, I often think about this, not just for Taylor, but for a lot of singers who are thrust into the requirement of being a dancer because of the nature of the music that they are best at making, but who routinely seem out of step or behind a step of the 4, 8, 12, 24 professional dancers that surround
right,
them.
Right. It should be said, are also not singing for 3 hours.
Right. And yeah, who are, yeah, and yeah, who are dancers by training.
By training, exactly.
And they are obviously there to sell like a broad narrative and to tell a story through bodily motion that Taylor is only partially doing. Taylor is kind of like signaling, but not totally doing. But I wonder if you, can you tell me a little bit about, because you talked a lot about Taylor's small gestures in terms of connection. So the two things I'm really interested in are, what are the small gestures that you found most effective? We mentioned the thing with the man kissing the bicep, which I think is certainly something that stuck out.
Although I'll say that in the comments for my article, some people pointed out that biceps actually is the plural and the singular from Latin. So wow. I was glad to be schooled on that by readers.
Shout out New York Times commenters. We love you all. We are grateful for your attention.
But yes, she kisses that muscle in a show of power.
Whatever it's called.
Yes.
So if you could talk first about small gestures, but then the second thing I want to, which we'll get to, is the relationship between her and the dancers and what they're doing at the same time. But let's start with the gestural stuff.
I didn't talk about this in the piece, actually, but she uses her hands a lot.
Yes.
Actually, in a way that a ballet dancer would use her hands. It's a kind of show of elegance that goes with some of her movement. And then she's constantly pointing, which almost leads to the next thing, which is about always maintaining this connection with the fans.
The pointing, I mean, again, you wrote a lot about Taylor uses movement to emphasize or underscore connection between her and, I would say, almost individuals in the crowd, even though there's 70,000 of them. Can you talk to me about how such a small gesture can have that degree of impact? Obviously, there's big screens.
And that helps a lot. I mean, the huge screens are, she's doing it, all the gestures are for the camera.
Yeah.
Simultaneously, I feel like simultaneously she's thinking about the camera and thinking about how it's going to read, you know, at the top of the stadium. It's kind of a magic. I mean, I don't know if I can say that it works. I don't know enough about how to do these things to tell you, you know, how she pulls it off.
but it does to you seem studied. I mean, obviously she's learning the choreography, but in those very precise, the small gestures, because I think it's easy to look at a small gesture and think, oh, it's offhand. It's casual. It's not part of a choreography.
I don't think there's much casual in that show. That seems to be a very studied show, which it has to be able to do it every night. And that goes for the other aspects of her physicality.
Yeah.
Right. Because she's also not only a pop star, but she's also like the singer songwriter. So she also does the, you know, strap the guitar around you and just stand there and sing and all of the iconography that comes with that of sincerity. But actually, that is something you have to do. Like, you have, some people are better at it than others. You have to have the wide stance. You have to seem comfortable. You have to seem confiding. And somehow she, you know, she's good at that too. I think that's actually probably where she comes from most. Maybe that's the deepest self. I don't know. We won't have to psychoanalyze, but
we're having a therapist on next.
Yes.
But it's funny because I do remember from Taylor's early tours, one of the things I was always very struck by is I thought the thing that you're describing about like the sort of sincerity of the singer-songwriter pose, like that was always part of the physical presentation. But in the earliest tours, like the real tours, like not like small gigs, but like, let's call it first arena tour, maybe.
Yeah.
She always had fans essentially right up to the edge of the stage. You know, maybe there's like a slight walkway or whatever. But sometimes she would go almost on hands and knees and almost maybe even sometimes allow herself to be touched by fans, which I thought was like a shocking thing to do for someone that famous, for a young woman. It was really, really striking. It reminded me a lot of hardcore shows. It reminded me a lot of going to like, you know, punk shows where audiences are like literally reaching to grab the performer. Obviously, she can't do that at scale in a stadium. But I think even dating back to that, and we're talking 2009 or whatever, I feel like there must be this conversation on day one of the setup where it's like, how do we maximize connection, especially in a space that's fundamentally unconnected or disconnected? Yes. How do we maximize connection?
And there, I guess that a lot of that is definitely thought about and worked on. And then at some level, also intuitive for her.
Could we talk a little bit about the relationship between her and the dancers? Because a lot of times during this show, I was sort of felt like they were a little bit at odds with each other. And I was sort of struck. I was like, not that we're in two different concerts, but you have a group of dancers, cocksure, know exactly what they're doing, telling a narrative. And Taylor sort of telling a parallel story sometimes, but not always. I wonder how you thought about what you thought about their interaction on stage.
That's interesting. I can see what you're saying. I read it more like they're the friend group or almost the like the audience surrogate. The whole thing is about the connection between her and us. So sometimes there's like friends on stage and she's sometimes dancing with them a little bit, and sometimes they dance around her in the style of the song. But actually, I think the most important thing they do is when they leave.
When
the dancers leave, they're there and they're around her and then they go away. And that happens many times in the show.
Sure. Oh, that's striking. So sort of from a narrative perspective.
Yeah. Narrative, emotional, emotional, physical, right? We are sharing her with these people and then we don't have to. Then we get her to ourselves.
Did you have any sense watching Taylor's comfort level of the difference between when she was in dance mode, surrounded by the team and doing some version of the moves, versus when she was in singer-songwriter mode or piano mode or so, like physical comfort or communication? How do they differ?
I feel that's kind of tricky. I feel like she was always comfortable in herself, but that doesn't mean that she wasn't also awkward.
Right.
So in the dancing sections, she's awkward. She's like, she's not a professional dancer. And when she does the moves, she's not doing them at the 100%.
Level. Yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course.
Right. Or of energy or precision, any of that stuff. But that doesn't mean that she seems uncomfortable.
No, and I think that's a good distinction to make, which is that for Taylor to communicate what a dance section of a show like that requires is not the same task that the dancers, the professional dancers, have to be performing. And in essence, if she was performing it at a higher level, she might actually seem less comfortable, and that would take you out of the show maybe a little bit.
I think so. And it also makes her, you know, less relatable.
Yeah. Talk about the relatability. You talk about that in the piece. Yeah.
There's a permission she gives over and over in the show, at least the one I was at. She's constantly talking to the fans and flattering them and thanking them and saying what it means that they know all the lyrics because she's had these feelings and they must have the feelings too. That's why they know the lyrics. Like that level of connection. I think when you see someone who's imperfect dancing, that helps that connection.
Sure.
It's not, there are other pop stars that are, you know, gods and goddesses, and we love them for that.
Right. I mean, this is the Beyonce question, where Exactly. Watching Beyonce dance at the level that Beyonce can dance,
you don't think you're going to be her.
No, right? No. There's an implicit gap. And actually, with the current Beyonce tour, one of the things that was coming out of the earliest shows was some Twitter chatter that she's not dancing at the level that she ordinarily dances, which in and of itself was like an entire news cycle or two. Just simply that she might have only been dancing at 70%. Right, that's a news cycle for Beyonce. Yes. Whereas for Taylor, that would never be a news cycle.
Right.
Okay, here's the last thing. You spent a lot of time that night looking at Taylor and her dancers, but I've got to imagine you spent some time looking around you in the audience. What do you see in that crowd as far as movement?
Huh. I think I can't really answer that question because I was paying attention.
You're too good of a critic is what you're saying.
Well, yes. Yeah. And also a dad.
Yes.
And my daughter was with me and the only other person I was watching was her.
Okay. I guess I can't fault you for that. I will say I did not go with a child. So like I was able to look around a little bit. And the thing that you said at the end of your piece about relatability, it really struck me because what I find at Taylor Swift shows is people, whether through fashion, through singing along, through dancing, whatever, are trying to find a safe space they're trying to find permission to be that version of themselves.
Yes.
And I do think that dancing is part of that. And the fact that Taylor herself, as you say, is not a perfect dancer, you don't have to show up and be a perfect dancer.
Right. No, when I can, I just thought about something I saw on the internet where it was a piece on YouTube about, oh my God, this dancer, they caught a person in the crowd doing the moves at the same time in the same shot as Taylor.
Okay.
And there was a lot of like this, oh, this great dancer. And neither of the people in that clip
are
great dancers, but they're both, to your point, like having a great time, empowered in just having fun.
Right. And also, I mean, this is the other thing. When I think about Taylor Swift 10 years from now doing another tour of this scale, I think it's unlikely to be as dance focused or as with, you know, where it's probably going to be maybe more piano or more sitting on a stool with a guitar. This might be the sort of the peak of Taylor's pop dance era. And it's striking how even at this peak moment for this in her career, there's still something where it's like, this isn't actually what I'm doing this, but like, we all kind of know that this is not the actual thing that I'm doing, that I'm here for. It's part of that.
I feel like it's more like a costume. Like there are lots of costumes in this show and some of the dancing is also a costume.
I mean, that's it. That's print, cut and print. Brian, I appreciate it. I hope you and your daughter had a great time at the show.
We did. It was a great show.
I mean, there you go. That's the hell with dance. That's all that really matters.
Right.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
We're back. Joining us, it's Yossi Salik. Yossi, welcome to Popcast.
What's up, babe?
Yossi's the host of Bandsplain,
That's right.
Yossi is those of 24 question party people. Yossi is a dear friend of mine. It's Yossi's first time on podcast, obviously talking about the most important musician of the last 20 years, right?
The Counting Crows. David Matthews.
Yes. The Dave Matthews. I knew somehow this would end up with a manifesto on the Dave Matthews Band. I regret to inform you that the Dave Matthews episode has been canceled. And today we'll be speaking about Eras Tour. Is that okay?
All right. Okay. You picked up the bat phone. You were like, are you available immediately right now
right.
to talk about Eras? And I was like, you know what, actually? Yes, sir. Reporting for duty.
That is how podcasting works for everybody who is concerned at home. That is quite literally how it works. Can you tell us, first off, where you saw the Eras Tour?
Las Vegas, Nevada, the City of Light. I think that's Paris, actually. I don't know what they call Las Vegas. City of Sin.
In the football stadium, yeah?
Yes, where the Raiders play.
Okay, that is a football team. Okay, do you want to set the scene for us a little bit?
Sure. I became extremely mentally ill after the first couple of shows, which I believe you weren't at the first one, and we won't bring up how you promised that you would take me to the first one, and then super conveniently when it came time we're like, I don't remember saying that, I'm already taking someone. Wow. And I forgave you somehow, which is actually insane.
Wow.
So after I picked up the pieces of my broken life from
really,
that
real big papal energy that you're bringing, you're wearing red.
That's right.
You're wearing Pantherella red.
That's correct.
For this it's, papal energy.
It's time for you to
atone for my sins.
For your sins. Okay.
Great.
So my friend and dear friend and fellow podcast host, Nikki Takesh, and I just started being like, should we just go? Should we just go to Vegas? Should we just drive to Vegas? Let's look at tickets. And we just started like obsessively looking at tickets. And I think at that time, we weren't really aware what the scope was going to be of ticket prices. But we did.
Did y'all overpay?
I think we actually got a really good deal, given what it ended up becoming as it went along. You know, I don't want to disclose how much we paid, but let's just say that it was a healthy amount. It was the most I've ever paid for one single concert experience.
Is it more than you've ever paid for an item of clothing?
No.
Yeah. Okay. See, that's not that much. Well, see, I just want to
like
encourage
us. Yeah. If you're like a normal
I just want to encourage people to have perspective. That's all I'm saying. Look, the fact is an item of clothing lasts forever. So you could pay a lot of money for it. That's fine.
Them.
I just want to encourage people.
Not the clothing I saw out there. Anyways.
No. Speaking of, so what'd you wear?
I wore whatever that you called an A shirt. Is that what we call them now in politically correct lingo? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like a men's ribbed white tank top that comes in a 3-pack.
Yes.
Braless with some Dickies and a bow in my hair, a little blue eyeshadow. I got a little festive. Sneakers, because there was going to be a lot of being on the feet.
Of course. You'd seen Taylor before or no?
No, I had never seen. That's part of the reason I really like. Was like, I don't care, hell or high water, I gotta go to this thing.
And so, pregame, apart from the kind of general spectacle of like, this is a major important thing, obviously I read John's review, so I kind of understand what's going on. Like, apart from that, what was your expectation level at? Like, was it a sort of intense curiosity slash itch, or was it, I need this particular musical experience?
I need this particular musical experience, because I've been really into Taylor. I'm going to like out my age. Like, I didn't get into it till like late 20s, but that might have been around the time. I don't have the encyclopedic brain that you do, but like I just like had like a clinical depression era, and I got deeply invested in Fearless, and I would listen to it like all the time. So since then, I've been pretty devoted to the musical output of Taylor Allison Swift, and because I've never seen her perform, I was like, and it felt, wasn't it a little bit giving, I'm not going to play again? For a long time.
This tour, the sort of rollout of this tour.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. And I think I tend to get pretty skeptical of pop star summations, which is to say, I would like to offer you a complete narrative of all the things that I have done in the last time period, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. because I have been to enough retirement concerts and things like that, final shows, band final tours.
They don't stay gone, babe. They never stay gone.
Right. So I'm inherently a little bit skeptical of it. So even though I agree that this did have a little bit of, like, I'm putting a bow on this era, on this, no pun, but like this era, this stretch of time.
I didn't think she was done forever. I thought she was going to, like, I thought her biological clock was ticking, babe. And at that time, don't forget, this was pre-Joe Alwyn breakup gate.
Still in the picture.
For all we knew, it was blissful domesticity. And I was like, maybe this woman is done with your malarkey and she wants to go have a child.
So you figured she's touring the world for 18 months, then she's off to focus on family.
Maternity leave for a little while.
I don't know that. I think if you are the president of Taylor Swift Enterprises, like, you probably can take maternity leave when you wish to take
and
maternity leave.
And then I don't know, my ass going to be 47 years old, go to the Taylor Swift concert? No.
Literally speaking to a 47-year-old who went to the Taylor Swift concert. Like, literally
It's your job.
Yes, but nevertheless, it's all of our jobs is how I like to think about it. Okay. Anything during the show that you did not expect? Like, well, let me surprising. Tell you,
previous to the show. So we made the entire playlist, of course. We didn't have to. It's already on Spotify. I lied. We didn't make it. The Swifties took care of that.
Great.
And then on the way, we were discussing Secret Song. And you know I'm a bit psychic. You know this, right? Actually, even the other day, I woke up on whatever day it was of the LA shows in the morning. And I was like, man, Exile goes so hard. I was just thinking about Exile all morning. And I got a text from Nikki Takesh. Secret Song was Exile last night. Anyways, on the way over to Vegas in the drive, I was like, I really want the Secret Song to be a white horse. And I feel like it is going to be. And it was.
So you incepted, you willed that into being.
I think so. Yeah. I'm a big white horse fan. I told you, I'm a fearless girly.
What do you make of having never seen her before? Because I feel like maybe I take for granted some of the things that people routinely express shock about with Taylor Swift concerts. I feel like every time Taylor's on tour, you get some people, whether it's celebrities or writers, who just like, I didn't know she had the stamina and the force of will and the gusto. And I'm just like, bro, I've been here for like 15 years. Like, there's none of this is surprising to me.
I mean, she's the biggest A+ student on the planet. She didn't train probably for 6 years before this. Like, she wasn't like in the hyperbaric chamber making sure that she could do 3.5 hours of heavy cardio. That didn't surprise me at all. It would have surprised me if she was like doing death drops or something. Yeah, you know what I mean?
It would have surprised a lot of people, be fair.
I was impressed, but I wasn't surprised. I was like, yeah, she's going to do it perfect. She does everything perfect.
Was there a part of the show that really stood out to you musically or performance wise that you really were like, this is why I'm here. I'm here for this.
I loved the like Folklore Mansion, or was it the Evermore Mansion? That got me right in my gut. I cried multiple times during this 3 hour situation.
Okay. So, and those albums, like, you find those albums meritorious.
You already know that you and I disagree on our Taylor Swift albums, and I ride and die for Folklore and Evermore forever. They're incredible. Also Lover. The fact that she
literally
started
wish
with Lover,
you peace and healing for this.
So the fact that I am peaceful and healed is why I love them. But yes, I was the Archer, babe. Goodbye. Goodbye. Extended outro. Dead. I died. Mm-hmm.
What was the crowd? Talk to me a little bit about what was the energy in the crowd right around you? Like, you know, there's always going to be like two or three people who like stand out where you're just like, they came to play. Yeah.
In
like,
front of us was unfortunately clearly a wealthy person who had perhaps gotten free tickets through his work and brought his family, of which only the mother was interested in being there. The children were on their phones playing games the whole time. Wow. So that was a bummer.
What age group are we talking
about?
They
were young. It was boys, and they were probably like 8 and like 6 or something. Okay. So it's they're not Swifties. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was a bummer. There was definitely like a very amorous couple also next to them, like a young white, perhaps in their 20s. The man also knew all the words to the songs. And I was like, okay, go off.
Great.
And then around us was just the general standard issue Swiftie.
you've seen, I know, any number of tours. This scale, there's not that many tours to compare it to, but I wonder if you think about it in the context of kind of like a long career slash life of attending shows, how does this kind of play in regards to other similar things you've seen?
I think it was a top five experience for me in a different way than maybe some of the other ones were, because I think she's probably the most important and biggest artist I've seen at her peak. You know what I mean? And to like, you were there, like when you really experience, you're like, this many songs, like this bitch has this many massive hits that like, and also just the collective absolute losing the mind of an entire stadium was so palpable. And it was just, it was something to behold.
And actually, just to pick up on that thread, like thinking about Taylor at her peak, it's funny. If you had said to me, is Taylor at her peak right now? I might have said no. So don't think she's, well, here's the thing. I don't think she's at her creative peak. And I don't think she's at her, technically speaking, her commercial peak. But there might be something about the nature of performance, maturity, growth, understanding your own history, relating your history to your current self, being able to manifest that in a visual performance, that she might be at her peak in that sense. I have been to every Taylor Swift tour. I've enjoyed all of them. To me, this might have been the tour that was the most narratively and emotionally robust from a storytelling perspective. And I feel like she's hit that in parts on prior tours, but a lot of times those tours have felt like really, really impressive recitations of recent hits. Whereas this felt like we wrote the whole damn book. And like, and that to me, being at a peak there, might be distinct from being at those other peaks.
I think that she's at her peak just simply by nature of God's plan, literally just fate. Because, okay, she has an insane long back catalog, 17 yes. years, right? But she's only, what, 33?
Yes.
So you don't have the thing where you go see an iconic artist. You've done this, you know, when you're like,
yeah, they're
I
rinsed.
Love seeing this, but yeah, you're rinsed, babe. Yeah, you're rinsed, yeah, you know? Yeah. And COVID made people unwell and then made them so excited, more than you ever would have been, to see a Taylor Swift concert. So there's that. And she came out before the basically streaming made it almost, and internet made it almost impossible to become as big as she is. So she has all these forces shoving her to the top. That's what I mean for being at her peak. Like, yeah, she might not, I wouldn't agree or disagree. Like,
it's
I don't.
It's historically specific, this
it's
moment.
It's historically specific. That's what I mean. And like, no one, I can't point to another artist that could maybe do this besides, I mean, maybe Beyonce, except that Taylor cultivated her fan base in a completely different way. It's like all been leading up to their ability to come show up for their queen. And it was truly, I've never seen anything like it.
I mean, I do think the parallel energies of Eras Tour and Renaissance Tour has been really, really striking to observe.
Yeah.
I do think that bottled upness of the 3 years of like, we haven't done anything. And it's not simply that we haven't done anything, but especially for the most like fervent fans, it's like 3 years of not being able to express
that. And how many albums? Three albums, right?
And not being able to express that in the room with the person.
Yeah.
It's not like they can burn it off every 18 months. It's just they've been sitting with it. And one thing about both of those artists, I think the fandom is multi-generational at this point.
Totally.
100%. So you have people who were 15 or 16 when the first albums came out and they're still showing up. We're talking about Taylor. And then people who are 10 or 12 or 15 now who are showing up now and are arriving to the party with Lover. So the marriage of all that energy, cross-generational, everybody focused in the same directions, it just seems very, very overwhelming and unlikely to be replicated at this scale.
I think ever. I think we've evolved past that possibility unless we bring back monoculture or something. But I'm also like super interested in the fact that there's certain artists that will always have a teenage fan base. I'm obsessed with this. I want someone to explain it to me.
even as they age, they will grow new teenage fans.
Taylor, I think Beyonce is a lesser example, but totally, because she's just so, but like the Arctic Monkeys, for example.
Never heard of them.
Okay. Let's not do this in front of everyone. Let's not do this in front of everyone. Do you know what I mean? Let's get Karen Gans on the horn.
This part.
No, I'm just the 1975, whatever. These are bands that ostensibly came out. They came out in the early 2010s. Why are they're in their almost 40? Why do they still have an influx of teenage fans? It's fascinating.
Given that there's unlikely to be a historically specific moment of this nature, certainly in the near future, there's no observable likelihood of that. Do you feel like, as far as your relationship to Taylor and to Taylor's music, is there a point to go again? Like, would you go the next time? Like,
I'm going to go again. I'm going to go in Europe. Yeah,
you are
for sure.
Go. Okay. Yeah. So is that it, you feel like there's still more to extract from it for you?
It was just so enjoyable. Like, I was so emotionally resonant for me. I really had a wonderful time. There's no reason. If I can, if I'm able, I would love to see it again.
Yassi.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
John Caramonica, thank you for having me, and thank you for silencing me. I just want the people to know that there's a good chunk of this that you're not going to hear because John Caramonica is a tyrant.
Given that, what song, what Taylor song would you like to hear as we go out?
Oh my God. Does it have to be one that was at the Eras Tour?
No, I mean, no. I'm a benevolent tyrant.
I've been really into Mine lately. Can we hear Mine?
We certainly can.
Yes.
Crack and Neck, that's the show. Thank you to Wesley. Thank you to Brian. Thank you to Yassi. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe, which is the YouTube show with me and Joe. That's at tinyurl.com/podcastdeluxe. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook/podcastdiscord, or email us to podcastnytimes.com. If you saw something on the Eras Tour in your city that was unusual or unexpected, let me know. I'd be curious to know some of the micro differences. We tend to think of these arena tours and stadium tours as kind of unchanging. But I'd be curious to know if there were little tweaks or something that you saw that you think maybe other folks didn't see. So email podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, that Apple or Spotify, that is YouTube increasingly, Pandora, and so on and so forth. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.